Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. The entirety of Chris Bynum's trial lasted less than 2 full days. 2 days for the prosecution to present all of the evidence against him and call all of their witnesses. And after all of that, there was still enough time for the defense to put on their full case and get in both closing arguments. I know I've said this several times before, but I think it bears repeating over and over again. This was an incredibly complex case involving 5 victims spread across 2 completely different crime scenes. And yet somehow, the police had their prime suspect in custody within 24 hours and the case officially solved within 48. Then, in just 2 short days, the entirety of this complicated case was presented to the jury. And Chris Bynum's fate, as well as justice for all 5 victims, was supposed to be determined in a Cliff Notes version of a trial. What I'm going to do today is walk you through the entirety of the defense's case in chief. After the state finished presenting all of their evidence, Graddick got his chance to sway the jury in Chris's favor. And if you thought the prosecution's case was short, you ain't seen nothing yet. Graddick's entire defense consisted of just 2 witnesses. Detective Moxley and a recall of Larry Brooks. And that was it. Now, in his defense, Graddick did want to call Officer Dame to the stand. Dame's testimony could have done a lot of damage to the state's narrative and Larry's identification of Chris. But mysteriously, Dame disappeared before the trial. At one point during a bench conference, Graddick told the judge that he wants to get Dame on the stand, and Collins, the prosecutor, interjected and said something to the effect of, "Yeah, good luck finding him." She explained that they were unable to locate Officer Dame for trial. Pretty convenient, right? Dame wrote the report where he documented Larry telling him that he didn't recognize any voices, didn't see anyone, didn't know who killed his family. No one was allowed to talk about that report on the stand because they didn't write it. That would be hearsay. And Dame himself, missing in action. Like I said, the defense called exactly 2 witnesses at Chris's trial. 2. The first was Detective Joseph Moxley. And the primary purpose for Moxley being called by the defense, and the reason he wasn't put on the stand by the state, was to put in front of the jury something he had written in his report on the night of the murders at the house. To refresh your memory, here's the line in Moxley's report that cuts against the state's narrative. Quote, "Corporal Jeff Trevino was also on the scene. He had informed me that the 12-year-old son was in the back bedroom and heard what he believed to be 2 male black voices. The son called the police after he had heard the shots and went into the front room and saw the bodies on the floor. He also said that the juvenile said he did not see anything." End quote. This was consistent with Dame's report, but as you know, Dame was nowhere to be found. Moxley was a little safer bet for the state. They still weren't about to put him on the stand themselves, but the damaging part of his report wouldn't carry the weight of Dame testifying. It's a report about something Larry said to Trevino, who then said it to Moxley. It's double hearsay. But it is something, enough for Graddick to at least take a stab at it. In the testimony, Gredick first tried to draw out what Larry said to Officer Dame, but Collins wasn't having it. From the transcript, quote, "Did you discuss this case with Corporal Dame?" "At that time, yeah, I spoke with him briefly. He told me basically..." "Did he share with you what he had learned as a..." "I think he was the ranking officer there." "He was the first responding officer." "First responding officer. Did he discuss with you what he had found when he got there?" "Yes, he did." "And were these things upon which you relied to further conduct your investigation?" "Yes." "And did he mention to you his conversation with a youngster whose name is Larry Brooks?" "Yes." "And did he discuss with you any conversations that he had with Larry Brooks?" Basically, Collins then immediately interjects, "I'm going to object to any hearsay response. I mean, you can talk about the fact that there was a conversation, but not what was in the conversation." Judge: sustained. End quote. Do you see now why the state avoided putting Dame on the stand? If he's not there, there's just no way to get that report in front of the jury. But Gredick didn't give up. He went at the issue from a different direction. He established that Moxley was one of the lead investigators. Then he asked if other officers on the scene were directed to make reports. Moxley confirms that the first responding officers would make reports and those reports would be turned over to him. Gredick then asked if Moxley himself ever spoke with Larry, which he did in the official interview. Moxley then confirms that Larry told him in that interview that he didn't see anyone, but that he was able to identify one of the killers by their voice. This was Gredick setting the trap. He then moved in and asked if any of the reports he read were inconsistent with that statement. I'll read you the exchange, the objection, and what was said in the bench conference that followed. From the transcript, quote, "Okay, and did you ever learn from him that he was not able to make an identification in any other way?" "Well, he stated that he knew one of the people that were in the house, knew the voice." "He knew the voice, is that correct?" "Yes." "And was this consistent with what you had found out already during the course of your investigation?" Collins interjects, "Well, again, same objection, Your Honor." Gredick: "Well..." Collins: "Can we approach?" The judge: "Yes." Then comes this bench conference outside of the hearing of the jury. Collins: "Had the little boy, when he was on the stand, been asked, had you said something different to the police officer, it might be a different story. But this is still nothing but comparing the hearsay statement that was in Dame's report, the statement to the boy, to Dame, to Moxley. So we have a statement twice removed at this point." Gredick: "Answer me this. Is the little boy now gone to places unknown where we can't find him? I want to subpoena him back." Collins: "I'm sure he's in school." Gredick: "I'm going to subpoena him and I want him to testify again." The court: sustained. Gredick: "May I do so by order of the court and get in touch with him, have him here immediately?" The court: "Yes." End quote. So Gredick was caught in this trap while the state wiggled out of his. But he didn't give up. If the only way to get the inconsistency in front of the jury was to put Larry back on the stand, then that's what he intended to do. In the meantime, the questioning moved over to discuss Chris's interrogation. Gredick asked if Chris seemed afraid during his interview, and surprisingly, Moxley offered up that Chris was expressing fear for his family while giving that statement. And this is interesting because no such fear is really discussed in the actual interview transcript. And Moxley wasn't in the room during the hours of alleged torture by Detective Donald, which is why I say I'm surprised that Moxley offered this detail up on his own. But to be fair, in Chris's PCR testimony, he did say that he didn't think Moxley was really in on what Donald was doing to him. And so far, I'm not seeing anything dishonest in his testimony. He seems to be, for lack of a better term, shooting straight. And after that part, Gredick moved on to the inconsistencies between Chris's statement and the actual crime scene evidence. He has Moxley confirm that Chris, in his statements, doesn't mention at all the blow to Liz's head and that he had the number of shots to each victim wrong. For example, he said that Amp was only shot once, but we know he was actually shot at least twice, possibly three times, depending if the shot to the wrist passed through to his neck. And Moxley seems to be playing it straight in his testimony. From the transcript, quote, "So what you had here was a person who was putting himself on the scene when all the deaths occurred, and expressing to you something materially different from what which was discovered later on, is that correct?" Moxley: "Yes." from your experience as a police officer that strike you as odd? Well, from initial response, basically anything could come out of it. Sometimes, yeah, you're right, it did strike me as odd. End quote. In reading Moxley's testimony, I'm starting to see why the state didn't call him as one of the lead investigators. He seems to be making no effort to spin his testimony to help the prosecution. He's openly admitted that Chris's statement didn't match the evidence, and the fact that he was afraid for his family during the interview, and even that he found it odd himself that the confession didn't fit the crime scene details. He even seemed like he was going to admit to Larry telling Dame that he didn't recognize any voices, before Collins objected, of course. But Graddick continued to hammer away on the inconsistencies. Namely, he narrowed in on the massive head wound that Liz sustained. He pointed out that Chris never mentioned it in either statement, and then he got Moxley to agree that it's an odd detail to be left out of the narrative. Now, one place where I feel like Graddick missed a huge opportunity was in regards to Sheila. Remember, she was found completely nude. That's a pretty massive and glaring detail that the killer would obviously know. But in Chris's confession, Amp shoots both women, and then they move the bodies. There's no explanation or even mention of the fact that Sheila was naked. And there was also no mention of that omission during the testimony. But even with that miss, Craddock did do some damage to the credibility of Chris's confession with Moxley's testimony. As he moved along, Moxley confirmed that he believed there were two killers in the house, not just one. And with his final question, he asked Moxley if he thought it was possible that there were even three offenders. From the transcript, quote, "And to the best of your knowledge, you don't know if there were three other people there. You don't know that, do you?" "No. There could have been three." "True. Yes." End quote. So in direct, Craddock shot some holes in the state's case. Chris was afraid for his family during the interrogation. The confession doesn't fit the crime scene evidence. And there were possibly two or three killers, not just one. The hope is that the jury would view that as evidence of a coerced confession and not simply as evidence that Chris was lying to minimize his role. Which, in cross-examination, Collins immediately made that latter point. In fact, that's all she does. Here is the entirety of her cross-examination. Quote, "Mr. Graddick asked you with regard to what Mr. Bynum decided to tell you in his statements, whether or not in terms of number of gunshots and whatnot. So as a general statement, let me ask you, detective, in your experience as an investigator, have you known people to give you statements to minimize their involvement in cases?" Moxley, "Yes." End quote. And that was it. That was the end of Moxley's testimony. And notice that Collins was careful. She didn't ask Moxley if he thought Chris was trying to minimize his involvement. Because let's be clear, the number of gunshots or any of these other details that he got wrong didn't minimize anything. It didn't take him off the scene, didn't stop him from pulling the trigger. So she just asked the one question, "Have you known people to lie in order to minimize their involvement?" He said yes. She ended her questioning, and Graddick didn't come back up for redirect. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show, live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Just to give you a clear idea of the timing of the trial, after Moxley's testimony, the court took a lunch break. That means that the entirety of the state's case and the first of the defense's two witness testimonies were all completed in a day and a half of trial. And after that lunch break, as promised, Craddock recalled Larry Brooks. And Larry's testimony is pretty short and sweet. Craddock asks a few questions, trying to establish if Larry remembered who questioned him on the scene. Again, he's trying to get to Dame, but he can't. Larry doesn't remember. And eventually, we get to the meat of the testimony. Quote, "Do you recall whether you were asked to describe anybody?" "Yes, I do." "And do you recall whether you were asked to describe anybody by voice?" "Yes." "Did you ever tell anybody that you could?" Collins, objection, leading. The judge, overruled. Craddock, "Did you ever tell anybody that you could?" "Could what?" "Describe anybody physically or by voice." "No." "You never did? And you're sure of that?" Larry indicates yes. Craddock, "That's all I have." And Collins, "I have no questions." End quote. And that wrapped up the trial. It was a short defense, but it really should have been pretty effective. There were two elements of the state's case that pointed to Chris, and two alone. His confession, which should have been called into serious question after Moxley's testimony, and Larry's ID of Chris, which, if the jury was paying attention, just got invalidated in that short bit of testimony. Larry testified that he never told anyone that night that he could identify anyone by sight or voice. And while those two short witnesses don't seem like much, in reality, there's not much more Craddock could have done short of putting Chris on the stand. At the end of the day, what it all came down to was the closing arguments, as it always does. Last week, you heard the state weave their story together. Today, you're about to hear how Craddock did the same. The following is his closing argument in its entirety. Quote, Craddock, "You've been inundated with evidence during the last 3 or 4 days, and I don't know if it's really as simple as one would first think when first examining the evidence, or is it as simple and Miss Benjamin as at this point appears that it is? I don't think that it is. It seems to me that when you come to court and you don't leave your common sense at home, that there are other things to consider as well. It seems to me that your interest should be what I think all of our interest is, and that is that we examine each and every piece of evidence and try to get to the truth. We try to get to the bottom of what's happening here, and we see by the examination of the evidence in this case that there are other conclusions which you can reach, and I submit to you that if you think about this evidence very, very carefully, that you will agree with me that there is something seriously wrong with the evidence that you have been confronted with during this trial. Now, I know that this is an emotional case. I understand that. I hope that you're not going to determine the outcome in this case because it is an emotional case. I hope that you're going to determine the outcome of this case based on facts and your examination of the facts, and that's as it should be. I think this is America, and we do things a little differently than others do. But our goal in prosecuting these cases and defending these cases is to get the truth so that no one is put into jail, no one has his liberty taken from him for frivolous reasons or for reasons that are based on anything other than truth. There is some things in this case that concern me and concern me a lot. You remember the testimony of Officer Donald, for example. Isn't it peculiar how when I questioned Officer Donald, the first reaction from him is to be angry with me? I don't know this man. I didn't come here to get angry with him. I didn't come here to fence with him. I came here to try to find out what happened, to find the truth, and defend this man to the best of my ability. But when the state asks him a question, he can respond immediately and directly. And when I ask him a question, he looks to the state for the answer and then he responds in an antagonistic way as if he wants to fight with me. As if this man has no right to be defended. As if I'm wrong because I have taken the choice to defend this man. Something that's always troubled me since I've been in this practice, people will ask me, how can you defend someone who has been charged with committing some kind of heinous offense? Some offense like murder. How could you possibly do that? How can you ask that question? How can you ask this question if you went to school here, if you were raised here, if you cherish what we have? How do you ask that question? Everyone has the right to a defense. You examine the evidence and you see if there are any things among the evidence that cause you to be curious. The first witness to testify, Larry Brooks, person for whom our heart goes out most. I didn't even want to cross-examine him. 12-year-old boy who has gone through a lot, who has to walk out of a bedroom after listening to something obviously horrible going on in the living room to find his mother lying there, bleeding, to find his aunt lying on the floor bleeding, either expired or about to, find Anthony Jeffers, who lives there with his mother, lying on the floor, apparently dead. That's got to be traumatic enough, and then he has to come to court and testify as to what he saw. I didn't want to ask him questions about that, but it was important to ask him this question. Who did you see? What was his response to you or to me? I saw one person from my vantage point in the house from the bedroom, and that was a tall, dark-skinned man with a big nose whom I had not seen before. What was that man doing? That was the man who was seen by Larry doing the shooting. Not Christopher Bynum, but the guy with the nose. Did you see the other person whom you heard talking in the living room with Anthony? No, I did not. How do you know who it was? I recognized his voice. Think about that. I'm sure that Larry was making every effort to be honest and truthful for you and with you. I'm not for a moment attempting to convince you that he was not telling the truth as he perceived it. I believe that he was. But think about what he said. Think about what he said. I heard the voice of a person whom I know as Chris. When was the last time you heard or talked with Chris? I only met him once. About what did he say about a month before? And when he met him, he talked to him calmly. He was not yelling, and he spoke very, very briefly. In the night that this incident occurred, he told you that the voice that he heard was the one that was screaming and hollering, and he had never heard that voice in that way before. And you think about it, and think whether you are even capable of distinguishing that. But that's not all, and bear in mind that he never saw this person whom he described to you as Chris. Think about this. How do you know Chris? Several things. One is, Chris is a person who has a gap in his teeth. This is the person he knows as Chris. He knows this. You saw Chris, stood right up there. There's no gap anywhere in his teeth. But there's plenty of references in the testimony, or at least one reference to either Shaky or Terrell, have neither a gap or chipped tooth. And I submit to you that on the evening of these killings, that there was somebody in this house whom you have not seen. I submit to you that there was somebody in this house who was not called as a witness. People who were in control of the police and whose interest is best served because now they can culminate an investigation without doing any damn work whatsoever because he's made a statement. Who are not here and you ask the question, why weren't they here? Where is Shaky? Where is McIntosh? Where is DeAndre? Why isn't he here? He doesn't come to me and make a statement. I don't have control over him. He's a state's witness. I don't have him. Where's Terrell? I don't have him. He's the person who went to the police. They know where he is. Wouldn't that truth help just a little bit? Should we at least have the opportunity to talk to them and ask DeAndre, where were you that night? And who were you with? And you and Terrell stand up here. Let me look at your nose. Ask yourself. When you examine that horrible, horrible scene. A scene, by the way, that had first, the first living person to witness it was an 18-month-old baby. Ask yourself, just how did this man manage to carry this off? How did he manage to do that? The state has been very clear in explaining to you that the wounds inflicted on these people were contact wounds, which meant that the weapon had to be against the body. How do you do that? How do you do that with one person, one single person out of the three, making an effort to disarm or fight or defend themselves against the perpetrator? Where there are three persons and one person. I'm not saying this that they should have been heroes or heroines. I'm not trying to suggest something that silly or frivolous, but I'm talking about reality. I'm talking about what people normally do. There has to be some effort generally to try to defend yourself. Can you for 1 minute believe that if Anthony Jeffers was the first person killed, that the two persons behind Anthony Jeffers had to be behind the one person who first killed him? That nobody made a step toward the person with the weapon to stop him or defend themselves? And can you believe for 1 second that if that's not the order in which it happened, that he approached one lady first and put a weapon against her head, against her face, and someone else standing right next to her did not move for a second, and nor did Anthony Jeffers move for a second to stop this injury, to stop this slaughter? Unless when the fatal wound was being inflicted on Anthony, there was somebody else. I submit to you that there were more than just one other person. There were probably two others besides the first shooter, or the only shooter from the evidence holding these people, or having these people in such a position where they could not put up a defense. It wasn't that they didn't want to or would not have, but now you can see that while Anthony is being slaughtered and shot in the head, that two people back here are unable to move because some ass has a weapon in their face and they can't move. How much more sense does that make? Think about it.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Continuing with the defense closing, quote, think about this. How reasonable is it? How much sense does it make that a person who has been involved, actively involved in the senseless killing of three human beings, and when now he supposedly is opening up to you and telling you the truth because he wants to tell the truth, he wants to bare his soul, he wants to bear the truth? How can he miss this important fact? I shot Anthony 3 times. If I shot Anthony myself, I would know if I shot him 3 times, especially if I'm close to him, especially with a weapon right up against his head. How then do I not know that each of the other two people have been shot 3 times by me? How in the hell do I not know that? How do I get confused by that for 1 minute? Unless I'm not privy to the facts. Unless I'm making the statement for some other reason, and Officer Donald is my reason. Officer Donald is the slick one, the one who didn't want to talk to me. Is not the great Officer Donald who would have you to believe in terms of his work? Do you believe for 1 minute? Think about it. Think about when you were 21. By the way, Chris described by this young man was a Chris who had told his aunt before that he was 24 years old. He's 21. What sense would that make? It makes no sense. But think about when you were 12. If you were in the police station, or if you had a kid who was 21 in the police station, Collins objects. Judge, at this point, I'm going to object. Mr. Graddick. Graddick interrupts. Withdraw it. I will. I didn't interrupt them in their closing argument. I'll withdraw it. Continuing on. Do you believe that the police are going to bring you down to the interview room for no reason, no apparent reason? You've already made a statement 12 pages long. For no reason, you are in the interview room. You're not there because you were asked to be there, and your girlfriend is in the police station and the detective bureau where you are. And we got the runaround about the rooms, and I know what the Gary Police Department detective rooms look like. I know better than the officer what it looks like. You don't believe for one minute that that man didn't go to Christopher Bynum and say, "God damn, it's time to tell the truth. We know the story." And here's the story. Your girlfriend is next door. There she is. And if you don't tell the story, I'll tell you what's going to happen. He had already indicated to him that he was scared to death for his family. And that fear was genuine because Officer Moxley believed it. And he told you that. You think for one minute that didn't happen? You think for one second these officers were so kind that when they bring them down and 15 minutes later, without him making a move, he knocks on the door and says, "Hi, I want to talk to you. And now I want to bare my soul. I want to tell everything." Poppycock. You know it's not true. You know it's not true. Bynum knows it's not true. And not only that, when they got what they wanted and the manner in which they wanted to get it, everything stopped. We heard no more of McIntosh. We heard no more of Jackson. Because nobody wants to go ahead and finish their work and make sure that there are no clues left, no strings not to be tied. No one cares. No one really gives a damn. The work is over. And that's a shame. That is a shame. You think about this. I think about this. Two people are found in a field. Two people whose pictures you saw were not the smallest of people. And two people are dragged without the help of someone else in a manner that these people were. You think that there wasn't somebody there? And you think for one minute that there isn't more to be done in this investigation until we are sure that we've got the person who's responsible for killing these people? Think about it. She's right. Use your common sense. You think there's not more to be done? Wrong. Wrong. There is at least one guilty person walking the streets of this community stalking someone else, preparing to take a life of another innocent citizen, and that's because someone decided that they had done enough work and wouldn't do another thing to wrap this case up the way it should have been professionally. They got him and they are gone with him. And now they're leaving it to you to do the dirty work. I am not pleased with this, and you shouldn't be pleased with this. Some of us fought for this country to make sure this didn't happen. And here it is, as big as day. Makes me wonder why I ever left the shores of America for what? Think about it. You think about somebody who is sitting down revealing the details of a highest horrible murder of two innocent women who haven't done a thing to a soul on this earth, who takes a blunt object and smashes her in the head such that it leaves that kind of injury. It's not a gunshot wound. And that's not a gash that the doctor was talking about. He told you about a wound that went across the head. That's what that is. One of those things that's incredible that the police didn't ask any questions about it. But the other thing that's even more incredible, that a person who is describing that never, ever mentions that. While bearing his soul, he never mentions that. Use your common sense. That makes no sense. Something is wrong here. I don't have all the answers. I'm not suggesting the state has all the answers. These two prosecutors are honorable people whom I respect a lot, whose ability I respect. Somebody didn't do their job. And this case should not be closed. The books should not be closed on this case. You just think about it. You think about a 21-year-old being in a police department brought down for no apparent reason. All of a sudden, there's this confession that closes everything. This girl happens to be in the detective bureau? Are you kidding me? Am I supposed to be that stupid? I guess I am, but are you? Miss Benjamin took great pains to satisfy you that there was no struggle in the house. Well, what she didn't realize, I wasn't trying to establish that there was a struggle. was trying to do exactly as she argued, to establish there was no struggle, because there couldn't be a struggle because there were more than one person in that house who probably had these two poor women captive while one person committed the violent things that he did. Anthony then proceeded to take care of the two women. So on that, the state and I are in agreement. While there are a lot of things during the course of this trial that we don't agree with and we haven't agreed upon, we sure as hell agree upon that. Let's accept this proof. The statement of Willie Marshall. And your heart has to go out for him too. He lost his brother. He lost a brother in this case. He wants somebody to pay for it. I understand. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, when you're trying to establish that, at least be honest. How critical a fact is it when your brother has been killed to be mistaken that you saw and spoke with Chris the morning before the incident, the same day of the incident, and he threatened your brother, and be confused with another statement where you said, I saw him and talked to him, and the threats were made a couple of days before? Think about it. Who it was who said that? It was him who said that. The last thing, ladies and gentlemen, given the evidence that I have viewed, I can't be certain what Larry saw or heard, but I suggest to you that he has not purposely, nor has he intended to mislead or misdirect you and not share with you the truth. And I submit to you that he made some mistakes, and he didn't hear what he says he heard. All I can ask you to do, you know, there's only so much we can do. I don't want to bore you. I don't want to say things that make everyone appear to be foolish. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to defend this man, and I just want you to give me a chance with this argument, and you examine it the way I've examined it over the last several weeks. And you think about how much of this makes sense. How much of it didn't make sense? You ask those questions. That's part of your responsibility. Yours is to find the truth because it doesn't always come from here. And you promised us during voir dire that you would not allow my client to be convicted unless the state proved his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. You promised us that you would not allow the burden of proof to shift from the state to the defendant. You promised us that you would not allow the state to put you in a position where you had to guess this man to prison. Promise me that you would make the state prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. It is the highest standard of proof in our system of jurisprudence is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And you promised me that you would not allow emotions to stand in your way while you attempted to do your job, and that you would do your job based on the facts and the facts alone. And if they weren't there, that you would make the decision that those facts demanded that you make. And lastly, you promised me that if you believed in a particular conclusion, if you believed and you were convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, and I submit to you that there's either way that you would not allow your opinion to be changed because the hour is getting late or because others were against you. And if you believed that the police department has not sufficiently done its job, if you believe that there are others, and as I do, that the murderers are still walking our streets, then you will demand that more be done and that this case be concluded and concluded properly. And so that at an appropriate time, each of these five people can now scream from their graves, thank you. Thank you. We appreciate the fact that justice has now been done and we rest in peace. Thank you. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice.
For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @TruthJusticePod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.